Friday, July the 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, tensions between Europe and Athens over the Greece debt crisis.
I do think that both sides do genuinely want to keep Greece within the euro, the common currency of 19 European countries.
Also ahead, the Orient and East Africa facing some troubles, plus the BET Awards. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The International Monetary Fund said Greece needs both debt relief and $56 billion in new financing from October until 2018. That according to a report released by the IMF on Thursday. Megan Green is chief economist for Manulife Asset Management. She speaks from Athens.
The IMF has come out and said what everybody who's been watching Greece knows, which is that Greece absolutely needs debt relief of some sort. But it's also gone and calculated Greece's financing costs over the next couple of years, given its growth forecasts, including what's happened recently over the past couple of days, which will really undermine Greece's growth. So the number's bigger than most people expected, but I don't think it's big enough. It doesn't include a huge pot of money for the banks, which I think Greece desperately needs for bank recapitalization.
And Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras's government has long argued that any new deal for Greece's creditors would have to address the country's debt by including some form of restructuring of the debt relief. And while the Greek government said the report continued a confession of failure on the Greek bailout, others criticized it. And now for more on the Greek debt crisis, VOA's Jeff Young speaks with Alex Nicol, senior fellow. He's at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London.
Mr. Nicol, in Greece, we're now facing a referendum on July the 5th. What would be the constructive purpose of putting austerity measures or a bailout plan to a popular vote? Is this just political cover?
It's very hard to know what exactly the motivations of the Greek government are at this time. It's a very confusing situation. Clearly, Mr. Tsipras is putting this package, which isn't really on the table anymore anyway, to voters as a means to try to get additional leverage over other European governments, his creditors. And because if he's recommending that they reject, that voters reject the package, and he hopes that if they do say no, that he'll be able to go back to other governments and say, you see, I have democratic backing for easier terms for Greece.
But you see a situation here. He could hold a referendum, and he could have a vote supporting his position, and then he could go back to the EU finance ministers and say, this is what the people of Greece
exactly
want. However, it's the EU finance ministers who hold the cash in their pockets at this point. And why would a referendum in Greece, whatever position that referendum may take, influence the finance ministers? They're the ones who have to decide, are we going to give more money to Greece or not? Do you see my position?
Yes, absolutely. It's true that right now we have a very antagonistic situation, that he has alienated the finance ministers and government leaders with whom he needs to do business if Greece is, you know, not to go belly up. There's a very poor atmosphere right now. And I don't think that a no vote is really going to sway them towards offering better terms in this atmosphere. Nevertheless, I think we have to look at what the ultimate aims of both sides are. And I do think that both sides do genuinely want to keep Greece within the euro, the common currency of 19 European countries.
If Greece needs liquidity, and because of its difficulties right now, its inability to cover the IMF demands on June 30th, etc., if it is locked out of the conventional money markets, raising capital, raising liquidity, I want to bring up the government equivalent of junk bonds. If Greece were forced to issue so-called junk bonds, high-risk bonds, where do you think the pricing of that risk would be? What kind of interest rate would it take to buy into a precarious piece of paper? What would you think?
Well, as you say, right now, Greece is in effect locked out of capital markets. Its only potential source of funding as other governments right now, and the governments that Greece is dealing with aren't prepared to lend unless there's some promises made by Greece that are credible. I think it's impossible to tell what a real market rate for Greece might be right now if they were borrowing, because in the absence of a credible package of reforms by Greece, nobody would really be prepared to lend to them. So even on the junk bond market, if such a market were even to exist as a possibility for Greece, and I don't think politically that's really feasible right now. And I don't actually think that we're there yet. You know, I think although there is this highly antagonistic situation, I do think that there's willingness on both sides still to reach some form of accommodation. You know, in the end, it's still a negotiation, even in the most difficult of circumstances, about terms.
Alex Nichol is a senior fellow for the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London.
That is VOA's Jeffrey Young reporting. And now we turn to what's being said on social media about the financial crisis in Greece. VOA's G. Abby Lee is here to discuss what people are saying online. Hello, G.
Hi, Steve. Hashtag IMF has been mentioned in more than 23,000 tweets in the past 24 hours. One of the users tweeting the hashtag was Project Syndicate, which is an online platform that publishes and syndicates commentary on a number of topics. It's at ProSyn on Twitter and wrote the IMF needs to heed its own advice and evidence on debt restructuring. Steve, I'd like to turn your attention to a prominent American politician who blasted the IMF. He's a 2016 Democratic presidential candidate and progressive lawmaker.
Is that Bernie Sanders?
Exactly. The Vermont senator wrote an exclusive statement to the Huffington Post and attacked the IMF and European authorities for imposing what he called excessive austerity measures on Greece. Sanders argued it is unacceptable that the IMF and European policymakers have refused to work with the Greek government on a sensible plan to improve its economy and pay back its debt. He went on to demand the U.S. and other world powers to grant Greece new debt repayment terms to allow its economy to recover from the financial crisis. Sanders is on Twitter at Bernie Sanders.
And what are the people saying about the piece on the internet?
I went to the Huffington Post website and read the top two comments by social ranking. The most popular comment was by a user named Carpenters for Bernie Sanders, and they wrote, "To read the comments here, you get the impression few Americans know what really caused the crisis in Greece. Bernie does, and he isn't afraid to say it." That comment got more than 100 likes. The next comment was by Maya D. at Northern Arizona University. She was critical of Sanders' stance and wrote, "So the IMF is basically a payday lender that preys on desperate countries? That's how this analysis reads to me." Steve?
And many thanks to you, G. That is VOA's G. Abby Lee. You know, you can stay on top of all the news at our website, voanews.com. And, of course, you can join the conversation about what's happening on Twitter. Our handle is at @VOA_IE. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
"This is a problem that inflicts almost every country."
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, the question is, could the world one day see a second Sunni awakening inside of Iraq? VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb reports now on a growing Sunni force ready to battle the Islamic State.
Senior U.S. defense officials with ties to the Iraqi government have told VOA that Iraq has recruited about 6,000 Sunni tribesmen fighters, a force many say will be critical in defeating the Islamic State. Officials say hundreds of those recruits are currently training under Iraqi security forces at Al-Takaidem Air Base in Habaniya, about 75 kilometers west of Baghdad. Brookings Institute senior fellow Michael O'Hanlon says the large number is a step in the right direction.
There are 6,000 who maybe are willing to work together. That may be even more important. You know, it's not so much that they're going to get great training in whatever amount of time we've had. It's more perhaps that that they now at least are part of a general concept of operation.
Security experts have criticized the Iraqi government for taking several months to actively include the Sunni fighters. They also say the training programs for the Sunnis are too small and disorganized. U.S. officials, however, have welcomed the large recruiting numbers as a sign of unity. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi said the pro-Islamic State group Sinai Province and other militant factions pose an existential threat to Egypt, other Arab states, and to the West. The group managed to hit 15 different checkpoints and several attacks on Arabi targets in Sinai earlier in the week. VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi spoke with David Darosh, associate professor at the National Defense University, to learn more.
Professor, one day after the assassination of Egypt's chief prosecutor, an ISIS-affiliated terrorist group in Sinai claimed the responsibility for attacking several Egyptian army targets, killing tens of soldiers. What do you make of that?
It shows rather frightening and disturbing new capability for the Islamist opposition in Egypt. What you're seeing here is the ability to mount multiple coordinated attacks in a rather sophisticated manner, which was aimed at overwhelming the security infrastructure of the Egyptian state. And of course, at the moment, the Egyptian army has said we and only we can guarantee the future stability of the Egyptian state. So this is a direct challenge to the basic premise of el-Sisi's rule.
So why do you think he defaulted on his promise to finish off terrorism in Egypt?
That's certainly the impression that the Islamists are trying to give. You know, they want to let people know that they can't be safe, they won't be safe. And to a certain extent, you know, in the absence of a political settlement, some sort of reintegration, you're going to expect these sorts of things. Very rarely is an insurgency, particularly one that, you know, clearly is broadly supported within Egyptian society, an insurgency is very rarely completely defeated. Usually they are brought into government, you know, there's concessions made and things of that nature. And since that process has not started under el-Sisi, I think that the Islamist opposition has decided to say, okay, fine, let's see what you can do. We'll show you what we can do. And of course, the reports of this attack is that it was, you know, rather sophisticated, very well planned, very well carried out. It's the sort of thing that requires a considerable network and a considerable amount of public support. And at the same time, it also shows the immobility, the lack of flexibility, and the real lack of capacity in the Egyptian security forces.
So how did the Islamic State manage to expand its presence in Egypt?
I don't know if the Islamic State, as we think of it, has expanded its presence so much as an existing Egyptian movement. The Sinai had a problem with terrorism long before the Islamic State existed. It's just that they decided to affiliate themselves with the Islamic State last year, when that was kind of the, you know, the hot brand. It was the number one way to declare yourself as being outside the law and to scare people, to be honest. You know, it's a recruitment tool. It's a tool of fright. If this organization in the Sinai wants to operate among the people and intimidate folks, you know, to operate with them and to not cooperate with the authorities, you know, you have to give a great sense of power. You have to let the fence sitters, the waverers, know that if they don't go with you, something bad is going to happen. And so if you could affiliate yourself with what was then, you know, the most frightening movement in the world, then that's the way to do it. I don't think that el-Baghdadi is directing these attacks. I think that this is an internal Egyptian problem that has a an Islamic State flag slapped on it, but you know, it would exist with or without the Islamic State.
As David DeRoche, he is associate professor at the National Defense University, speaking with my colleague Mohammed El Shenawy. Well, a new report by the United Nations gives a bleak forecast through October for the Horn of Africa and the Great Lakes region. It warns of more intense and widespread violence, as well as greater population displacement and economic shocks. VOA's Joe DiCapua has our report.
OCHA, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, says the Horn of Africa and the Great Lakes region are home to some of the world's most vulnerable people. That's despite economic growth and progress in achieving the Millennium Development Goals. The report states that there has been a step change in the region's threat level in 2015. Pete Manfield is head of OCHA's regional office for Eastern Africa.
If we look at what the dominating humanitarian characteristics were for Eastern Africa 9 months ago, you could summarize it as a persistent high chronic food and nutrition crisis or emergency in pockets across the region, with a slow burn refugee crisis mostly dominated from South Sudan.
Things have worsened since then.
We've seen Burundi, the political crisis in Burundi, which is increasingly having regional impacts, not just in terms of refugee outflows, but actually starting to threaten stability in the wider region. We've seen the economy in South Sudan reach crisis point, both in terms of oil revenues and its ability to pay civil servants. And of course, we've seen Yemen get substantially worse, and we're on the verge of that becoming a new global crisis.
The humanitarian scenario says the situation in Burundi will most likely remain restive for the foreseeable future. Well over 140,000 people have fled the country since early April, after President Pierre Nkurunziza declared he would seek a third term. Yemen is included with the African hotspots because thousands are fleeing fighting there and going to Djibouti and Somalia. Those countries have their own migrant, refugee, and food security problems. Those fleeing Yemen are not only citizens, but African migrants and refugees now forced to return to the continent.
Now, these three crises, coupled with the protracted situation in food and nutrition, are presenting a new threat. And we think the line has basically been passed in the sand in terms of threat level. This is having compounding impacts on states, not just those in conflict, but those that are neighboring to conflict centers.
Manfield says these crises coincide with a record level of global humanitarian needs.
Our concern is that the region will be overlooked, both politically and financially. We need, obviously, adequate finance to respond, and we need the right level of political engagement to solve crises at their source. And that's never been more needed now in Burundi and South Sudan and Yemen in order to stop this deteriorating further.
Crises in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East have a common byproduct: thousands of migrants and refugees fleeing to Europe. Unresolved conflict and violence in Somalia and the Eastern DRC are having detrimental effects on neighboring countries. These include attacks by the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab in Kenya and the flood of refugees from Congo. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. federal law enforcement officials have found no links among any of the six recent fires at African-American churches in five southern states. U.S. Justice Department on Thursday said two of the fires were started by natural causes and one was due to an electrical fire. Fears that the churches might have been racially motivated, the fires there were prompted by the fact that they occurred in the weeks, that is, after the killing of nine worshipers at an African-American church in Charleston, South Carolina, on June 17th. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Egging on Uber, literally, as striking French taxi drivers throw eggs to protest the web-based ride-hire company and others like it.
Uber, c'est du travail dissimulé.
Taxi driver Ismail says Uber is illegal.
Dans un premier temps, c'est des gens qui...
He says people work without a license. They pay no insurance. And their cars are not up to standards, he says. But Uber and companies like it are in demand in cities around the world. And protests by cabbies occurring everywhere from Mexico to Indonesia are creating travel nightmares for commuters. And local governments are scrambling to deal with the new transportation model. But Anthony loves the freedom a company like Uber offers.
I'm free, actually. I'm my own boss, you know. If I don't want to work today, I can.
Uber operates in over 300 cities in 57 countries. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Good to have you with us. Black Entertainment TV, the television network here in the U.S., handed out the BET Awards recently, and the show featured some special moments. VOA Soul Lounge hostess Shauna Renee stopped by to chat with David Byrd about the show.
This week, Black Entertainment Television honored the best of the best for the past year with the BET Awards at the Microsoft Theater in Los Angeles. Here to talk about who won, who lost, and some of the performances is VOA's Shauna Renee. Shauna, thanks for joining us.
As always, it's a pleasure.
Now, this featured music, television, radio, video, and et cetera, but who were the big stars of the night? Who do you think kind of stole the show?
Well, coming in, we knew that Nicki Minaj, the rapper Nicki Minaj, and Chris Brown were probably going to show up more than anyone else. They had the most nominations of anyone else, and they both ended up going home with awards. But I think for me, there were two performances that really stood out. If you were around and in the clubs and having a good time, let's say the mid-90s, then you definitely know Bad Boy Records. They were running things at that time, and they just celebrated their 25th anniversary, and Puffy brought back almost everyone for a massive performance that included Mace, who we hadn't seen for a while, Faith Evans, who we haven't seen for a while, 112, and everyone got uber excited about Little Kim. We hadn't seen or heard from Little Kim for some time. So,
yeah, she hasn't. I haven't heard her name in any kind of music publication for a long time.
Well, she's been involved in a few internet beefs, as it were, with some younger and upcoming female hip hop artists. But she recently had a baby, so she's been at home doing the mom thing. But she looked fabulous and she sounded great. And as is always expected with Bad Boy, it was just one of the most energetic performances. I was standing on the couch, dancing along, having a great time. So that definitely stood out for me. And the other piece was the Janet Jackson tribute. She took home the first Icon Award, and her tribute featured the dance piece of Janet. We know Janet is a phenomenal entertainer and performer.
Right.
And a lot of that comes with the incredible choreography and dancing. And Ciara, as well as Jason Derulo, actually did some really interesting stuff with them. Ciara, flawless choreography. She got the look down. Janet showed up. She was there. She accepted the award. She looked absolutely beautiful, and she gave a heartfelt speech, and she expressed how excited she is about coming back and performing and reconnecting with the audience, and it sent chills down my spine. I'm so happy she's coming back.
Well, speaking of people who've made a career in this industry, Smokey Robinson was also honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award.
Yes, he was.
And had something to say to the young people about, you know, be thankful for the fact that you... I think he called show business a bittersweet wine.
He was very humbled, obviously, by the award, but I appreciated the fact that a man who has had such a phenomenal career could stand on stage and speak very frankly and honestly about where younger people need to be in terms of their mind, their talent, and their actions if this business is going to continue and Black culture in general is going to continue to grow.
All right. Thanks a lot, Shauna. That's Shauna Renee. You can hit her up on Twitter at VOA Lady DJ or at VOA underscore music. You can also hear her host the Soul Lounge. Find that by logging on to our website, www.voanews.com.
ban out in Los Angeles, California on Thursday. The district attorney there decided to not file felony charges against Sean Diddy Combs. 45-year-old hip-hop mogul was allegedly involved in an ordeal on June the 20th at UCLA's athletic facilities, where his son plays football, in which police said he wielded a piece of weight room equipment called a kettleball. Combs was arrested for investigation on assault with a deadly weapon, battery, and making terrorist threats. He posed bail and was released from jail hours afterwards. He was taken into custody. No charges to be filed against P. Diddy. Oh, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
This spring marked the solemn anniversary of one of the most tragic chapters in recent history, the 1995 genocidal slaughter of some 800,000 men, women, and children in Rwanda. The sad facts are well known. On April 6, 1994, a plane carrying Rwanda's president and his Burundian counterpart was shot down as it was landing in the capital, Kigali. Both men were killed, setting off a wave of revenge and ethnic cleansing. Extremist members of the president's Hutu people savagely attacked and murdered members of Rwanda's Tutsi minority and many moderate Hutus, too. UN peacekeepers withdrew after some of their troops were killed, and the rampage continued for 100 days. Rwandans from all walks of life have worked heroically over the past 20 years to repair their lives and move forward. But an important part of the rebuilding remains unfinished. Most of the men accused by an international criminal tribunal of playing key roles in the genocide fled the country, and nine remain at large. None should enjoy impunity. The United States is cooperating with the Rwandan government, Interpol, the United Nations, and the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda to make it harder for the fugitives to continue to elude justice. We are offering rewards of up to $5 million each for information leading to the arrest, transfer, or conviction of these murderers. Augustin Bizimana was defense minister in the interim Rwandan government, helping to prepare the genocide campaign and preparing lists of people to be killed. Businessman Felicien Kabuga is alleged to be the main financier and backer of the political and militia groups that committed the genocide and transporting death squads in his company's trucks. Fulgence Kaishima, police inspector in the Kivumu commune, is accused of orchestrating the massacre of thousands of Tutsis and Hutu moderates there in April 1994. Proteus Mprianya, commander of the Rwandan Presidential Guard, is alleged to have directed his soldiers in killing the Rwandan prime minister and murdering 10 UN peacekeepers guarding her home. Charles Sikawabu, mayor of the Kishita commune in Kibuyu Prefecture, is accused of instigating massacres at the Church of Mubuga and elsewhere. Charles Riandakayo, the manager of a restaurant in the commune, is accused of taking part in the church massacre. Ladislas Entiganzwa, mayor of Nyakizu commune in Butare Prefecture, is accused of being one of the main instigators of the genocide in the prefecture and of making speeches calling for eliminating Tutsis in the region. Feneyes Munyarugarama, a lieutenant colonel of the Rwandan army, is charged with helping direct and take part in the systemic killing of Tutsi refugees fleeing the fighting. Aloise Indibati, mayor of the Kesobu commune in the Kebuye Prefecture, is accused of conspiring to kill Tutsis in the prefecture and being directly involved in massacres that took place in the area of Bisesero between April and June 1994. If you or anyone you know has information on any of these men, it can be provided with complete confidentiality. You may contact the nearest U.S. embassy, or within the DRC, you can call 081-715-2501, and internationally at 243-81715-2501. Also by email at wcrp@state.gov or on the internet at www.state.gov/warcrimesrewards.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.